This episode has been recorded remotely, so do bear that in mind while you hear the audio.
Okay, silence outside.
Sound.
Rolling.
Camera.
Rolling.
Yeah.
Kill.
Hi, you're listening to Have I Made It Yet? I'm your host Ashwin Rajshekar and I work as a sound engineer based out of Hyderabad. This podcast features candid conversations with various professionals from the world of filmmaking. They come from various departments with different experiences of the industry and their own unique stories to narrate. So the guest today is Tanya Chhabria. She's an editor. We studied in the same college. She joined in 2016, finished in 2018. Since then, she's been working on a lot of projects. She's the one person who I think has the most prolific work. She's worked on social media content. She's worked on promotions. She's worked on short films. She's worked on ads. Have you worked on ads?
Yeah, I have.
She's worked on ads. She's worked on web series. Also feature, although not narrative, but documentary. One of the first projects that you worked on, which I also watched, is Bhadra. So can you tell me, like, what are the kind of experiences that you had during your bachelor's that pushed you to want to do filmmaking?
So one of the first films that I ever edited was Bhadra, and it was extremely documentary-esque. And, you know, the thing with editing that film was that we had to get creative about everything that we had, because we had very basic equipment. We had DSLRs that we were shooting with. We knew that sound recording on DSLRs was bad. So what we did was we used selfie sticks and we stuck our phones on them and sort of used it as a boom pole to record sound. And it was so interesting because we would just be like running with different people with like a selfie stick and a phone in our hand. And that was my first experience with sync sound as well. And also Foley, because there were times where I think this was like a different assignment, but yeah, I needed the sound of like a good car crash. And I was like looking up car crash and everything morbid possible online, but I just couldn't get the kind of sound that I was looking for. So then I was like, okay, you know what? I'm just going to record this. So I go down into my storeroom and I start playing GTA. And I take like recordings of like the car drifting and crashing into things. And because I really needed that sound effect and I needed to sort of cater it to the edit that I had already done. So I knew how I needed it to flow. So I don't know, I felt like in college, I was so experimental. And I think I found all of that so exciting, which is what just made me fall in love with film, because it has the capacity for you to be experimental.
How did you get to this point where, you know, like right out of film school, I think it took you maybe a month or two to get to a point where you're doing so many projects, and it's, you probably didn't take any break in the middle, right?
Yeah, not really. I don't think I actually had a break. I think once I started working, there wasn't a break. I started off with promotional work because honestly, entry into the industry is pretty hard, especially if you don't have a contact. So you look for anything. So I happened to see a Facebook post and there was a requirement for an assistant editor and I applied. And, you know, you think that, you know, your college degree is probably going to get you somewhere, something, but not really. Maybe I was getting paid 5,000 rupees more because I had a degree in film, but 5,000 rupees is not much. So I started off as a promo editor. And then I went on to work on my first web series. Once I got a chance to do long format, so I'm actually quite in love with long format because I love the storytelling process of it. That's not to say that short format doesn't have storytelling. It's just a lot more faster, and the deadlines for short format are such that you just have to put it out there as soon as possible. So you don't get to sort of roll in it for a while and mull it over and think that, okay, how do I want to tell this story? Do I want to tell it from this angle? Do I want to use a mid shot? Do I want to use a long shot? You don't have that much of time to think about all of that. So that's why I prefer long format. So when I got the opportunity to work on my first web series, I jumped at it with like both hands. And yeah, after that, I worked on another web series, and then I worked on a documentary. And then now I've returned to short format again because the industry is shut.
Okay, so we talked about the kind of work that you'd done before in college and in film school.
Primarily short films, yeah.
Yeah, all of them are short films only. I don't think we did anything long format except probably for one outlier called Zaman, which was directed by my classmate Atul, which was around 40 minutes long, which you assisted for editing.
Yeah, yeah.
But moving from that, you did our grad films, which is Plucked and Aprapta. What drove you to, you know, take up these projects, and what was the kind of thing that motivated you to make sure that you were giving your best for these two, you know, your graduation projects, besides the fact that you're going to get graded on these?
To be honest, actually, I don't think the point of being graded actually ever crossed my mind. Of course, I thought that would just be a byproduct of, like, it had to happen. But why I made these projects my own would be because, again, I was working with people who function at the same frequency as I do. Also, I was brought in very early on in these projects during the script writing itself. And I really, really, really liked the scripts, which is what made me say yes. I think once you have your heart set on a script, at least my process is, once I've read a script, I can immediately visualize it. Once I've seen the shots, I know how I'm going to cut it. I think what drives me is wanting to see what I've imagined in my head. And I know I've reached it when I can see it in my cut. That, okay, this is the best that I can do, and this is what I imagined. Yeah, so what drove me would just be that, the story itself.
Is that the one thing that you look for the most? See, I mean, at the beginning of your career, you're not at a point where you're able to choose things, right?
Yeah, very true. When I was working on promos, I was editing promos for shows I didn't necessarily like, and shows I would most probably not have ever watched if it wasn't for the fact that I was editing the promo for it. I think, like you said, like right now I'm dabbling in a couple of things. If I'm going to take on the extra project, give it my time, it is most definitely going to be after I have read the script and liked the script. When it comes to everyday work, however, yeah, I don't have a choice in the kind of content that goes out. I mean, I think that's also a privilege that comes with time and experience, because right now I don't have the privilege to say, no, I don't want to do this. It does not align with my ideologies. I can't do it. I mean, eventually I'm hoping that I do, and I have the options to choose which story I want to tell and how I want to tell it. I actually have a funny anecdote with regard to this. So when I was working on one of these feature films, we were doing the promotion work for it. The editor on board had asked me to edit an item song. And I think I remember the minute he came into like my edit room, I was editing like some romantic song at that point. And he came in and he was like, I need you to edit this item song. And I think that was the first time I just like, I looked at him and I was like, I'm sorry, but I don't think I could do an item song. I had to apologize to him saying, I'm really sorry, but that goes against everything I stand for and I can't do it. I think he was shocked because that was the first time ever that an assistant had said no to him. So he didn't know how to react. So he was like, okay. And he left my edit room. And then I sat down in my chair and I was like packing my things because I knew I was fired. I knew I was fired. But he actually did end up firing me. He let me hang around and yeah. I think I found it interesting that you said no. And I was like, okay, that's a first. But yeah, I wouldn't recommend it to anyone joining because I think I just lucked out, honestly.
Yeah, I feel like the most common reaction to something like that would be, I mean, of course, there's the them being shocked, which makes sense because nobody ever says no to anything in this industry where, you know, you really have to say yes to everything to survive till a certain point. But also you have the whole ego part of it. where
yeah.
one might feel like, how can they say no to me?
Yeah,
I have hired them. They are supposed to work for me.
But you get better at handling that. When you start off, of course, you may be bad at it, but eventually you kind of learn how to handle your work environment.
What's the work environment like when you're editing? Footage is sensitive. They don't let you take it home, right? At least, I'm not talking about short content here. I'm talking about long format things, especially ones which have a higher budget. They expect you to finish a lot of things in a very limited amount of time.
So long format is actually a lot more spaced out than you'd imagine it to be, because editors, at least assistant editors, are brought on board as soon as the shooting starts. So every day you actually just get a couple of scenes to edit that you need to sync, of course, and then you need to do your first lineup of it, which will be shared with the main editor of the project. Editing even for web series is the same. You will get the footage of what they shoot every day. Then you sync, line up, give it to the editor. Now, the main editor of the project doesn't necessarily come in every day. Will probably come in once a week, twice a week, look at the lineup, see how much content is there, then decide whether, you know, they want to start the edit right now or wait for more to be shot, because there are days where not much gets shot. And then there are days where a lot of scenes are covered. I think each platform functions a bit differently. So
each platform meaning?
Amazon Prime, Netflix, and Z5. These are the three that I've worked with. With Prime, I think it was pretty spaced out. We were doing it pretty luxuriously. But with Z5, we didn't get that. For them, putting out the content much faster was key. In that process, for instance, sound designing really suffered. There were days where I would send out the final cut of an episode to the sound guy at maybe 11 p.m. He or she would get like 2 hours to work on it. And then it would be out at 2 a.m.
You're talking about the episode as a whole?
As a whole.
And this is not reality TV, right?
This is not reality TV. This is for Z5, the app.
So the sound person gets 2 hours to do everything, including design and mix and Foley and everything.
Yeah, music as well. Music included.
Music also.
Yeah.
Do you get the music beforehand?
How we worked, at least with Z5, was that first we were downloading tracks off YouTube and using them as scratch tracks. But then we subscribed to Artlist and we started using music that we had the right to use. Yeah, I think that was what went in with the final cut after that, because we didn't have time for the music, like a musician to actually work on it. There was no time for a music composer to like fit into this equation of 2 hours that the sound guy had. And I mean, the thing is also, when you edit, the lineup that you end up doing, yeah, it might not be the best. Of course, we do not have Foley and things that, you know, sound designers really put in to sort of create the ambience. But, you know, the basic SFX and stuff, we always lay that down. And we make sure that there are no gaps in the audio, in the sense that there are no jumps. Like, suppose you're cutting out a dialogue that someone's saying, we always fill that space up.
Right.
So
make sure that the room tone is consistent.
It's consistent. I don't know if that reduces the work of the sound designer. I'm sure the sound designer deserves and needs much more time. But that wasn't a luxury with Z5.
Yeah. But talking about music, I was talking to Smaran, who did music for Surprise Pachis. And of course, he's also worked on a lot of other stuff. We were talking about using temp tracks and how it can very often be limiting for him as a music producer, as a music director. But at the same time, do you feel like when you're editing, you need a temp track?
Absolutely not. I don't need a temp track while I'm editing, because if my edit does not work without the music, then it just doesn't work. The whole point about editing is that it needs to work as a scene. If you need music to drive the emotion through, then you're not doing your job well. I mean, at least that's what I believe. And I completely agree with Smaran. He's absolutely right when he says that, because once you have seen a scene in a particular light with a particular track to it, it's very difficult to sort of detach yourself from that and do something different or create another emotion that you could have perhaps done better than the editor did, because you're trained in that, so you'd automatically be better. The only time that we've actually used temp tracks was with Z5. But when I worked with Prime and I worked with Netflix, we would make original tracks for the show itself. Like, Lakho Mein Ek had its own track. And after the point, what also happens is once you've like edited at least 2 to 3 episodes, the musician also starts preparing like themes. So, you know, this will be this person's theme, this will be this person's theme. And they send it across to you. So you can use the musician, you know, the composition that they've sent you itself in your edit, and you don't need to rely on temp tracks again.
But by doing that, you're also kind of imposing the positioning of that music, right?
Yeah, definitely. You are. The ins and the outs, of course. But then the thing is, you know, when you show your episode to the director, and when you're sitting with the director or the producer, it has to be a complete compact cut. You can't have no music. You can't not have SFX. You can't not have a continuous room tone. Because these things, like, is what they need for the viewing process. Yeah, and that's something you just have to do. I mean, then you sort of impose it on the music composer. But, well, you win some, you lose some.
Do you feel like you can tell that, you know, this is a scene that requires music?
I actually have a very hard time deciding that. Especially because I think I've worked without music for so long that when someone tells me to add music to a scene, I'm like, no, but that's so unnatural. Because in my everyday life, the only time I have music is when I go on like an app and I play the music. I don't, like, when I'm talking to my mom and I'm having like a monologue in a heart-to-heart, I don't have a background track playing.
Maybe you can practice.
So,
Alexa, so play honestly, dramatic music.
So honestly, it's still something that's unnatural to me, but I'm trying to come out of that. And yeah, just trying to weave in the music wherever I can see that it's fitting.
I think it's important to make the point that Aprapta, which is one of your grad films, had no music at all, except for one point.
Yeah.
Even where right it was completely within the scene and it was just percussion.
Yeah, it was diegetic.
So that probably influenced you, maybe?
Yeah, you could say that. But then even when I edited Plucked, I didn't add any music to it. I mean, Plucked also was given to a music composer after my edit was locked. So in that, in fact, I hadn't even added like temp tracks. That wasn't a thing that happened. I don't know what exactly made this happen, but yeah, it did happen. And now I need to unlearn this.
So when you're being approached with the project, of course, you can't always say no. But what is the ideal situation for you?
When I'm approached with a project?
Yeah, like at which point in the project would it be ideal for you to join?
Being approached with a project is an ideal situation for me. But jokes apart, the ideal time would be right when like the script reading is happening. Because I honestly believe that if you have an editor on board from the pre-production stage of your film, the visualization of your film will be so much more enhanced. Because editors spend so much time with footage, thinking about how to cut, when to cut, what to cut to, that they have a natural instinct to know what works and what doesn't. Of course, an experienced director will also have that, but there's always a certain amount of oomph that an editor can add. And, you know, sort of make the work of the director easier. I mean, at the end of the day, making a film is a collaborative effort. It doesn't have to fall on the shoulders of just one creative head. It's a creative group of people coming together and making a film. This is, I mean, something I honestly believe. Like, every project I've worked on, I look at that project as my own baby. Because if you don't, you're not going to give it your all. You're not going to, you know, sit down to actually imagine what it can be like.
I feel like if you don't do that, it's hard to even finish the project, to stay till the end.
Yeah, definitely. You know, when you lock in, like the first thing, when they approach you with a project, they say, hey, this project is going to be for 3 months. Laugh it off, it's going to be for 6 months. There has never been a project It's gonna be 3 months. That's impossible.
Yeah, it's so true. It's so true. Like every single project that I've been a part of till now, they give a time frame. It's going to exceed that time frame by at least 3 times.
Yeah.
Like Pachis was supposed to be shot by end of December, maybe Jan of 2020, but it went on till July, August. Of course, COVID was to blame. This project that I'm doing currently, Targinatom, it was supposed to be done by March of 2021. But now we are looking at probably December of 2021. And
it's just bound to happen. There are so many things that can go wrong. Actor schedules change. You know, they weren't able to cover a certain number of scenes in a day. Someone was ill. There are just so many things that go wrong. And you have to have that buffer period.
Yeah.
Which is also pretty relaxing because, you know, once you've started a project, you're like, oh, great. As a freelancer, I am set for the next 6 months. I do not need to think about this. I do not need to think about what my next project is going to be. That anxiety only happens when you're ending the project and you know that the end is near and you need to find something
else. But that holds true only if it's a project where, you know, the producers are able to pay you even if there's a delay.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. If they aren't, and I mean, you're still given the option of whether you want to stay on or not. But then, like I said, if you're attached to the project, you will stay on. And
yeah,
I think I would. And
yeah,
you just give it your all.
How do you plan? Like, you know, they give you a certain time frame. And assuming that it's a very indie production and they won't be able to pay you if things go bad. And things do go bad more often than not. And then there's a delay. But you also need to, you know, get the bills paid and get the money coming in. But also you need to manage your time so that, you know, you're giving the amount of time that each project deserves. How do you kind of plan around these things when everything is so uncertain?
So the thing with indie projects, at least, is that I think the way I would plan it would be to sell my soul, do some corporate work, make like a piggy bank of a sort of fail-safe. Then, you know, when you don't get paid, you have the money to sort of push you through, at least. At least that's how I would plan it. And also you can alternate projects. Maybe do one pet project and the next project do something that just pays really well. Because you want to be able to do the projects that don't pay really well. And therefore you have to do the projects that do pay well and you might not agree with. Just so that it pays you enough to get through your indie phase.
Yeah. I mean, that's where I feel like it really helps when you're attached to the script. Because you're still motivated to go ahead, despite them not being able to pay you consistently. Because you're attached to the script and not to the money that they might be giving you.
Yeah. And also people, like you're working with. If the people you're working with on that indie project are just not nice to you, then you're just going to be like, you're not paying me, bye.
Yeah. I think more than anything else, unless you're one of the people who is like very emotionally invested into the script, the most motivating factor when it comes to any project is the team that is around you.
Definitely.
Like if you enjoy working with these people, if you're able to have fun with them, then you'll continue to do it, even if it's going to be a little difficult. And you'll try to find a way to do it.
Yeah.
Whereas if they are not nice, then you'll find a way to leave it. It's going to be the opposite.
You'll find excuses and they'll come very readily.
So on the topic of having a good team, when we are in college, we get to be around people that we are comfortable with. We kind of grow with them in a manner to say. When you're making a film with them, you have so much more freedom to experiment so much more. And the kinds of things that you do on set is not limited to just your role. What was it like, you know, moving from that point where a lot of what you do is very motivated emotionally to a point where you're doing projects where you're moderately motivated?
Yeah, I mean, when I was in college, you would be everything. You'd be line producer, you'd be art director, you'd be editor, you'd be boom handler. Though that need is very rare because sound designers are usually very particular. But I mean, if the need arises, you'd do it. You have to go from that sort of thinking into, okay, this is my job description and this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And the transition is actually not that difficult because, again, like you said, you know, you're not also as invested in the project because you come on board so late. Like, I've never ever edited anything where I was brought in at the scripting stage post-college.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people assume that editing starts when the shooting is done.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what happens. Like we've, you know, discussed, that's not something I agree with. And I think most editors would also not agree with that. They would ideally like to be brought on pretty early on in a project. So you have to go from that to, okay, this is my job, so I'm going to do this. I'm going to go in, sync, edit, and then leave. Which also gives you sort of time to do a lot more with regard to projects, that you can probably take up two projects while you're working. Of course, there are times where a project can get a little more demanding and you have to extend yourself and say, you know, the person might be like, okay, I need you to sort of do this as well. I guess then you have to decide whether you would be willing to extend yourself. However, the word no in the industry is blacklisted. If you are an assistant, the only word you have to know is yes. It's a scary place to be because it can happen that you... Like I said, most of it is word of mouth. So if you say no and word spreads about that, then it'll be very difficult for you to find a project and to find people that you're willing to work with.
How does that word spread around?
So for instance, suppose I want to tell a particular editor or a production company that I want to work on their project. They'll be like, okay, please send us references and links to your previous work. So then you would send them the reference of previous work that you have done. And in some cases, you don't really have such a big portfolio that you can just leave out the one that left a bad taste in both of your mouths. So you give them as a reference. And if this production company happens to call them up and they say, you know, oh no, I did not enjoy working with her because she's too pricey, she's too picky, then that's it, right? Because then why would the production company want to invest their time and energy in someone they don't know? Because all they know is, look, I have this A4 size sheet, resume, says film editor, and her name is Tanya. That's all you are to them, an A4 size PDF. That'll obviously translate once you start working for them, but initially, no.
I feel like, again, this goes back to having that ego when you've been on in the industry for so long. One of the things that I've noticed is that seniors in the industry tend to feel that we take things for granted.
Yeah, I think they do because they're coming from a time where they've worked on projects where they did everything. You should never say no to anything that your production company asks you to do. While I understand the sentiment that, you know, okay, hey, this is film business. You got to do what you got to do and get the show on the road. I still feel like you should have the option of saying no without having to face the repercussions of it. And without being so scared.
Yeah. Right?
I think it starts at such a small level and then it sort of just escalates to like everything where you don't say no to anything that happens, no matter how unjust it is. And yeah.
But I feel like doing multiple things on a set, it really depends on what your position is on that set, how invested you are. Like if it is a movie that you and I were making and you asked me to make chai, I would probably do it with no problem. But there is a significant difference in this. And imagining if I am in a position of power and I ask someone to do something that they don't have to do. That, yeah, I think, exactly, is abuse of power.
Yeah, point. Exactly. Because the dynamic is so different, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because when we approach it, we're approaching it as equals. Whereas in that dynamic, you're not equals. And the person not in power is very much aware of that. Yeah. When it comes to being a part of a film, it obviously is a team. It's not one person's vision, but it's a lot of people working together. And at that point, communication is something that is very, very important, without which it could end up breaking the project, at least in the sense of the timelines that you have. So what are the kind of conversations you have with the director?
As an editor, to begin with, the first conversation you have with the director is, of course, to understand the view of the director. You have to be able to see the film through the director's eyes. And once you have that down, you can begin your edit. Post that, discussions are usually on an even plane because you tend to work, suppose you're making a film, the editor, as we've already discussed, is one of the last few people to come on board. So, you know, you're going to choose to work with an editor that you actually align with mentally. It'll be an easy conversation and there'll be like equal amount of respect. Suppose the director suggests something but an editor doesn't agree with it. You can have a back and forth because both of y'all just want what's best for the film. There are obviously situations where that does not happen, which is why you see things like director's cut and editor's cut released separately.
Snyder cut.
Yeah, I mean, there are situations where you just don't agree with each other's ideologies on a certain thing. That's, again, not saying that, you know, either of them are wrong or that they'll never work together again. They probably will. But, you know, they just wanted to put out their versions into the world.
Yeah. You know, you hear stories of movies spending 10 crore rupees on a song or 5 crore rupees on a fight sequence. When it comes to making a film, at the end of the day, it's what makes sense, what flows the best. How would you deal with a situation where you have to remove something that has so much value, but not for the film?
I just cut it. I've done it before. Like every scene, right? There is so much of sweat and blood and money that flows throughout the filmmaking process. But if it's not adding to your film, you have to cut it. You just have to. You cannot let yourself get clouded by the fact that they spent 5 crores to shoot this. That is not what you're getting paid for. You're not bringing any value to the money you're getting paid for if you're going to buy into all of those concepts.
Yeah.
However, the producer will not be very happy about this, which is why you have the producer's cut also that releases sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, usually the producer's cut is what gets out to the theaters.
Yes, it is. I remember one of the first few classes in film school, again, our editing teachers told us that if you're working on a film that has Salman Khan or Shah Rukh Khan or Amitabh Bachchan in it, their intro shot cannot be a long shot. It has to be a close-up. You're paying Salman Khan, Shah Rukh Khan, Amitabh Bachchan crores, not for the long shot. Nobody's coming to see that. It was a very difficult class because I was like, but what if the long shot works but the close-up doesn't? But yeah, you have to sacrifice. You have to. You also have to really pick your battles.
Yeah.
When you're editing a film, you have to see what you're completely married to and only fight for that. You can't possibly fight for every small glitch that you see.
So you give up on a lot of things.
Just to win some, yeah. You have to.
Yeah, this is something that even Krishna had told, I think, when we were recording. Okay, how much of your time do you think is important to spend observing things around you? Because a lot of filmmaking is recreating what you have seen in your life, even if it is exaggerated, even if you look at, you know, Bollywood stuff. It really comes down to very basic emotions and then putting it out the way you feel is the best way to put it out.
Yeah, I mean, I've always believed that you need to have a life aside from what your profession is because it just makes you better at your profession. I know that I need to be observant of the world I live in because I might bear witness to a situation that I might need to edit later in my life. That would just make my edit so much better and have like a flavor to it. If a writer doesn't know how an apple tastes, it's going to be hard for the writer to describe how the apple tastes. Likewise, if I don't know how a particular scene plays out in my real life, how am I supposed to only count on my imagination of it, right?
Yeah,
I think it's very, very, very important to have a life besides work. So, you know, even if you are just joining the industry, like you'll experience a burnout so quickly if you give it all of your time. And then you'll start thinking that, okay, you know what, maybe I don't actually like this. maybe I shouldn't have converted what I thought was a hobby I liked into a profession.
Yeah.
If you space it out, you probably won't think that.
You really enjoy things you do as a hobby because you're doing it leisurely. But once you have to do it on time and once you have to do the same thing all the time, I feel like it's very easy to get to a state where you feel like this is not something that you're meant to do or want to do. That's the point where motivation probably wouldn't help, right?
Yeah, you're sort of just burnt out then.
What's the best way to deal with something like that?
Take a break if you could. But if you really can't take a break, then I think the only way to sort of work around it would be to keep doing it. Because I mean, I know that there was this one period when I felt like I couldn't edit anymore. When I was in college itself, I remember like all of my assignments were, I was finding it twice as hard to do and the outcome was pretty bad. And I was so upset with myself. But I mean, then at least I had like a good peer group. I had great teachers who sat me down, had a conversation with me and told me that it's not the end of the world and that life goes on. And you need to just move ahead with it. So keep at it. I think my editing teacher said this to me, Reema ma'am. She just went like, you're facing an editor's block. So I was like, yeah, I think so. And she started laughing and she was like, so keep editing. I was like, okay. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't know what to do in case of a burnout because I feel like that is also a different mental space. And I feel like I'm not equipped to answer that.
Fair enough. Before we move on to questions that I have from Instagram, I want to ask you what it's like with the documentary process. Because the previous two episodes with Sai and with Pranav, both of them have worked extensively with documentary. What they have told me is that when compared to narrative films or fiction films, the amount of control you have is completely zero when it comes to documentary. Because even if you do your research, you don't know what's going to happen once you go there. And what's going to happen on the edit table is something you cannot predict.
Yeah, that's very true. They probably work in the pre-production and the shooting part of the documentary because it's completely inverse for post-production. Editor is God when it comes to documentary. The editor is the one that structures the entire documentary. Yeah, of course, there is a tentative script in place, right? There won't be any kind of shooting without a tentative script. There is an idea, a framework of sorts that they want to work with. But like you said, things are unpredictable. Interviews don't go as planned. You cannot make the people who are speaking within your documentary rehearse. They have to be candid. So this isn't like a thing where you can submit a question and be like, these are the questions I'm going to ask you. So, you know, you prepare and then we'll shoot.
Yeah.
Right? Documentary, for the most part, is supposed to be objective. I disagree with the fact that documentaries are objective, but that's just...
I mean, as objective as you can get, perhaps?
Because
every documentary, you are trying to put a message out and no message is purely objective, right?
Yeah, exactly. So even as something as simple as the placement of your camera is subjective, right? I mean, subjectivity sort of just leaks into it. It's as objective as filmmaking can be. So what's actually interesting is that the first film that I ever worked on in college was sort of shot in a documentary-esque form. I think that was like my first taste of filmmaking where I was like, okay, I can feel the power as the editor. I can cut to anything. That was still a fictional piece. So I had to work within a certain script, but I still felt that freedom. That going ahead, then I worked on a docu-series for Netflix, which still isn't out, I think. Shooting was stopped because of COVID. Working with that, right, there was so much of footage. The thing with documentaries is also the amount of footage you have is literally double when it comes to like a fiction project. Documentaries have so much because everything can get into a documentary. If someone says, oh, I saw this on the news, you can cut to that news snippet. That is also footage for your documentary. That's why it's just so vast and it's a beautiful playground because You can just weave everything. You can make whatever you want, right? That's what I love about documentaries. But also, I genuinely believe that you need a lot of experience as an editor to be able to do a documentary, because that was one of the biggest things I felt when I was working on this docu-series, was that I don't think I'm experienced enough to give them the clean cut that this documentary deserves. Because when I looked at like my timeline, it never used to look the way I imagined it. And the thing is, I didn't think I was equipped with the knowledge to make it look the way I imagined it. And yeah, I think that's extremely, extremely important, that at least what I believe, that you need a lot of years of editing to be able to get into documentary. Or you need to have studied documentaries so much that you know like the ins and outs of it. You also need a very strong director.
Strong how?
I mean, in terms of the ideology, they need to know what they want from the documentary. Yes, it can change on the edit table because of something someone has said. But for that to happen, the editor needs to start cutting towards something to get derailed, right? If you don't have an initial goal, then it's going to be really hard.
So you work with an end goal in sight?
Yeah, you definitely work with an end goal in sight, but then you will get derailed because some interview will say something that piques your interest. So see, that's the beauty of it, that, you know, even though you have an end goal in sight, you can't be married to it. You can't be like, you know what, I'm going to take this footage and make it say this. No, you have to let the footage speak for itself. If the footage is saying something else and you're saying something else, your documentary is going to look bad. It's going to seem really forced. Mm. So you have to let the footage speak to you. And you have to listen. It's imperative that you listen. Which is, I think, true for even fiction. You can't force an emotion. It's either there or it's not.
You said that you need a really strong director. And I feel like the whole process of making a documentary film is inherently messy, that which is something you have to deal with. You cannot make it clean. The process is such. But is there some things that the team or the director can do to make it easier for the editor and essentially the film to progress?
One would be, while you lay down what your idea of, you know, creating this documentary is on the editor, you don't impose it on the editor. If you impose it, then again, you're forcing something. You have to give the editor the freedom to just wing it. Because honestly, that's what documentary is. You're winging it. While you can plan certain sections of it while they come to you, for the most part, you will never have an entire episode cut out in your mind. You might shoot something and be like, yeah, okay, you know what, maybe I want to put this in episode 3. But then suddenly you're like, no, let's open with this. If the editor says, let's open with this, you should be open to that. You know, you should be ready to switch things up, change it up, which is also why I said it needs to be a strong director, because only a director that is sort of well-footed and understands the process of documentary making, you know, would be willing to do that. The best part about the documentary that I worked on is that, you know, the editor would also come on board after we've had enough of time to sort of just, you know, make our own cuts of each episode. So I remember that I had like at least 3 different versions of each episode, of 3 episodes that we had planned. I had the complete freedom to make those episodes with whatever footage we had, which was a lot of footage. So, I mean, just imagine, right? Like the B-rolls, the news clippings, the interviews. It's so exciting in that sense, because you can put anything in a documentary and it'll pass. You can put text on a black slate and it'll pass. You can play music on a black slate and it will pass. That's the beauty of what a documentary is. And yes, I know I'm completely starstruck with documentaries, but it'll be a long time before I ever try to edit one myself again.
Like, I worked on a documentary, on a docu-series recently. I've talked about it a little bit. The whole process is so different. It's not ideal that I joined the project after the edit was done. But, you know, like you said, there's so much to explore. I have never been to the place that the documentary was set in. It was set in Palestine, and I've never been there. I had to rely on my imagination of what it's like to kind of create that soundscape around it. And I had so much fun doing it. It's completely different from the process that you described, where you have multiple lines to follow. But it's a different kind of exploration where I am able to imagine a world which is probably not 100% accurate, but it still fits with the project.
I've always found that extremely beautiful because, I mean, sound and edit are married to each other. Sound has to work well with edit, which is also what I find extremely curious. Like, I wanted to ask you as well, like, what is it like coming on board on a project like in post-production so late when you just have to sort of... Because I know that I hate it when I come on board late. Do you think you would like to be brought on, at least at this stage of when it's being edited, because you feel like you could add something to an edit that the editor would have probably not thought of?
Definitely. But the thing is, I haven't had a single experience outside of film school doing that. Either I've been part of a project doing just sync sound, or I've been part of a project where I'm just doing the post-production. Right now, I'm doing a project in which I'll be doing both. So once that's done, I'll be able to answer the question in a very detailed manner. But since I've gotten used to it, I don't mind it. I've been lucky enough to work on projects done by editors who have a good sense of where to cut. Maybe if I would have seen, you know, the earlier versions of that particular project, I would have definitely had suggestions. But I close my mind to that part of it because I know that there's nothing I can do to change it. And I continue working regardless, and it's fine. I think it works well for me, at least at this point. I don't know if I'll be spoiled once I do this project. Maybe not.
You probably will. There's no turning back.
Yeah.
Once you get a taste of it, you want more.
Meta question. With the documentary, have there been points where they ask the character, the subject, to go for a retake?
Yeah.
But that sounds so bizarre.
It sounds extremely bizarre. I know a lot of directors, like I've heard stories, I don't know a lot of directors, but I've heard stories with the editors that I've worked with that if they've ever worked on a documentary, the best way to do a retake would be to just say, oh, I'm so sorry, there was a technical error. Because you know what happens then? You're not putting the person on the spot and telling them that they have to say it exactly the way that they have said it before. Except you're saying, okay, you know what? We're just going to have to do that again, that bit again. Mm. Which I found very interesting because it still keeps the interview candid. You know, you're still not making it a rehearsed thing. Even though now, but you know what's also happening now is that your character, because in the end, everyone becomes a character in a documentary, is better equipped to answer your question because they'll be able to do it in a more structured fashion. So, yeah. Retakes definitely happen. And again, it's the director's art to how, you know, they make that retake happen.
Hmm. How do you feel being one such character now?
I think
like,
I've been... Wow. No, Is that why you said it's a meta question?
A note to the listeners. Yes, this is exactly why I refer to it as a meta question. Because we had to record this episode thrice, but legit because of software glitches. So quite a bit of what you're listening to is retakes. Not this question though. Do you feel like it's going to affect the way you look at it and essentially edit it now that you have experienced it firsthand?
See, the thing with editing a documentary is always that you have to be extremely, extremely strong when it comes to your ethics. You have the power to weave what someone has said in a different context completely and change the meaning of what they are saying. You have to refrain from doing that. There were so many times when I was editing the documentary where I would look at what someone has said and place it in the most controversial spot possible. And then I'd look at it and I'd be like, wow, what am I doing? I'm violating that person's right by doing that because they have not said it in that context and I have no right to use it in that context. So I think what this would actually bring to the table would just be that, would like enhance that aspect of it, that you have to be ethical. You cannot do this. You cannot, yeah, just don't.
Yeah, unfortunately, like, a lot of documentaries are meant to be sensational. Like, that's the idea that they are built upon, and they end up doing that. But sticking to the topic of retakes, either with documentary or narrative, do you feel like retakes make it better or worse? Because I had Vishnu on one of the episodes,
mm-hmm.
and we were talking on the subject of retakes. He told me that especially when an actor is coming to a set without a workshop, without any pre-production work, add to it if they are new actors, it really helps to do a few retakes, because the first take, they're going to be a little clueless.
Yeah.
And once they understand the blocking and the staging, and this goes for even non-experienced actors, once you get a hang of it, the flow of it gets better. But at the same time, you do it too much. By the end of it, you end up making it too mechanical.
Yeah, I actually completely agree with that. Because, yeah, so there's this common saying. I mean, I'm probably not going to get the saying right. But I think it's called the first take trap and the last take trap. For the first time, when you see a shot, you are probably going to get wowed by the acting. Don't use that shot. And definitely not the last shot, because it's probably going to be mechanical. Because the actor has done it so many times. So the sweet spot that you're looking for is right in the middle, which would be the third and fourth take.
I mean, not necessarily in the middle, right? Somewhere
around anywhere. The middle. Yeah. Somewhere around the middle. But that's not always true. As an editor, it is your job to look through all of the shots. There are times where I have used the first take because I honestly think that the actor was able to capture the emotion better than in any other take. Or that, you know, maybe I didn't agree with the emotion that the director wanted to bring out, but rather I agreed with the emotion that the actor caught on, right? Because the first take, like you said, is usually that, where the actor is bringing their thought into it. Yeah, so it really depends on what you agree with.
Okay, so what's the difference that you find between working on, you know, content for the internet versus feature films and short films and all of that?
Okay.
Also, before you answer that, is it fair to label it as video editor versus film editor?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I would just label it as editor, but that gets confusing because of the newspaper editor. Honestly, I think your profession is that you're an editor. That's what you are. And if we were to be bougie about it, we'd say montage. It's actually really different because you have so much more time when you're working on long format versus when you're working with ads and, you know, digital content that has to go out, like, you know, your 2-minute videos and stuff. Like, for them, it's all about viewership, right? And there are so many times where every time I've sent an edit, the first, you know, feedback that I'd get would be, एक कड़क मॉन्टाज डालते हैं इसके, यू नो, पहले इन द बिगिनिंग एकदम कड़क वाला. एंड आई जस्ट आई एम लुकिंग एट दैट ईमेल एंड आई एम लाइक ओके आई नीड टू डू अ कड़क मॉन्टाज नाउ टू सॉर्ट ऑफ बिकॉज दैट ग्रास्प्स द अटेंशन ऑफ योर ऑडियंस. And I mean, I see that, you know, there's obviously like they've done like a whole poll and I'm sure there's like a science to it and stuff. But you just feel like, okay, but you know, my edit is not telling a story anymore because it's beginning with just a bunch of random shots. And so, yeah, that's very different from long format because in long format, you have the time, you have the patience to tell the story from and determine whether you want to tell it from a particular angle, how long do you want to stay on that angle. It's just so much better.
Okay, let's move to questions. A couple of questions that I have on Instagram from people. Ink on Water, Tejas, who was the director for Plucked, has asked, what's the favorite thing that you've edited?
Oh, that's really difficult. I can't pick between babies. I mean, what kind of a mother would I be? No, Tejas, cancelled. I'm sorry, they're all my babies. Nope.
What's the project that you enjoyed working on the most?
Okay, I think I would say Aprapta, because again, that was one of the projects that I was brought on pretty early on. However, with Plucked, I got good insight into all of the processes of filmmaking, because like you mentioned before, we don't have music in Aprapta, but we do in Plucked. That sort of introduced me to not only music composition, but also how you record Foley and how you record musicians coming in for your particular film. So I'd say a little bit of both of the films, yeah.
TISIZ_Rohit has asked, what is the role of an online editor? And is an online editor essential during production?
An online editor is the editor that sits on set and transcodes all of the footage and does a basic lineup of each scene that has been shot, because the director wants to see if the scene is playing out as the director has imagined. So again, this is not a job I envy, because I feel like it's very, very, very demanding. And what was the second part of the question? Sorry.
Is an online editor essential during production?
Yes and no. Because you should be able to rely on your imagination, but it's not like it's hurting the process anyway. So
I feel like it is essential, because especially when you're being a part of smaller projects, when you're on smaller budgets, something that you experience very often is storage issues. You have limited number of memory cards and you have so much to shoot. Having an online editor is really going to help you, where they are able to organize all the cards. Like, they are making sure that once one card is finished, they are immediately going to copy everything to the hard disk and make it free. So I think they are absolutely essential if you're going to be shooting, you know, in high resolution.
But that's,
and you're going to be having space issues.
See, that's a different job altogether. That's a data wrangler. See, the person that usually copies all of the footage and makes sure that you have backups and stuff is actually a whole other person. It's a data wrangler. Yeah. But that, again, that's in like big budget projects. I'm not sure about smaller ones. It could be the same person.
Projects that I've worked on, it's like it's you put all of them together and have one or two people doing it.
Okay.
Next question is from Robert Deakins. He's Rana, who's the editor of Pachis. He asks, compare editing with stitching a dress, 10 marks.
He wants me to make a comparison.
Yeah.
And I get 10 marks. So will you get in touch with him and let me know how I've fared by the end of this? Okay. Editing and stitching a dress are extremely similar, because you have footage, which would be the cloth. You have thread, which would be the software that you use. And then you have the master G that sits and does the work. So you have to choose what size you want to make it, how you're going to stitch the arms of the dress, whether it's going to be sleeveless, whether it's going to be full sleeves. What is the neck going to look like? Is it going to be a polo neck, or is it going to be a deep neck? These are all decisions that the emotion of the footage will guide, and the emotion of the cloth will guide, and the material, and how flexible the material is, what material you choose to make this particular dress. All of these would be the same kind of thoughts that you would have when you're making a film and editing a film, because that's essentially how basic it is and how vital it is. Because without editing, film would just be you wrapping a piece of cloth around yourself and walking around.
Good one. But it was supposed to be not more than 250 words. I forgot to mention that. But it's okay. Thank you so much for making so much time for this across the three different times that we've had to record this episode. Thanks for your time, Tanya.
Okay, bye.
That's the end of this episode. I hope you had a good time listening to it. This episode has been edited by NC Vineet, and the music has been composed by Rohit Tambulwadikar. Creating this podcast takes up a lot of time and resources, and you could help us by becoming a patron with as less as $3 or around 200 rupees every month. This gives you access to ad-free episodes, shoutouts, behind the scenes, and a lot of other exclusive content. Head over to patreon.com/haveimadeityet. Also, make sure to follow us on Instagram for regular updates, the link to which is in the description. Thank you.